I gotta watch that.
House Committee on Revenue for March 30th, 2009 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go slightly out of order and open the public hearing on House Bill 3370.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3370 creates a first citizen program whereby taxpayers who make voluntary contributions to the general fund may choose to be publicly acknowledged for that contribution. And the amount of the contribution is determined by using a tax rate that is 1% higher than that prescribed by statute. And the bill also would require the Department of Revenue to prepare a form and instructions to enable taxpayers to make these contributions, and it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009.
Representative Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to myself. Thank you for members of the committee having me on this morning. I found out relatively recently that this was coming up for hearing. It is an idea that doesn't come from me, but I think it's an interesting one and worth the committee discussing and maybe setting forth a work group for the interim if we're not ready to enact something in this session. It's an idea that comes from Martin Taylor, essentially to create a public-private fund that, in order to be successful, would require public-private partnership so that you'd be, in, under Martin's terms, you'd be an Oregon First citizen and you could contribute an additional 1% to your taxes. By doing that, you'd get a set of benefits, and those benefits would have to be created through a bunch of work and a bunch of organizing, and you'd want some public and some private benefits, and it might be a free parks pass, it might be a special color license plate, because we don't have enough of those, it might be it would be maybe, discounts at Fred Meyer, et cetera, whoever else wanted to help out. Another potential element of the idea would be to allow people to self-direct in the money that they contributed, to pitch into the fund that they wanted to pitch into and support the program they wanted to support. And the advantage, I think, of that would be to allow for incentives for programs, governmental programs, to perform and communicate that performance to folks. It's a relatively simple idea. Again, I think it might be the kind of thing that the Revenue Committee might want to consider when we receive May forecasting numbers and we're looking for creative ways to generate revenue. My primary benefits that I see to it are three. First, a little bit of money raised. Second, starting to, particularly if we do it in a self-directed fashion, provide a mechanism by which we incent programs to communicate their value and perform well. And third, to start connecting the idea of government not as sort of a separate entity, but as a vehicle by which we try to accomplish common endeavors. I know you have another and maybe several other matters to hear this morning, so I will keep that short. And again, the request today is, I mean, obviously the Revenue Committee can do whatever you want to do, but to the extent you wanted to put forth a work group to explore an idea like this, that would be one possible step.
Bravo. Questions for Representative Jefferson Smith? Thank you very much for bringing the bill to us this morning.
Thanks very much for having me. It was short, too.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 3370? Yes, sir. Come forward.
Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and from our perspective, this is kind of cap and trade we like. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else this morning on House Bill 3370? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3370. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3268.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3268 creates a subtraction from personal income taxes equal to the amount of capital gains attributable to inflation. It would require the Department of Revenue to develop inflation factors for holding periods ranging from 2 to 50 years and would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2010.
Thank you. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. What this bill does is hopefully try to adjust what I would call a fairly large tax injustice that very few people know about, and it's the capital gain, it's the rate paid on inflationary gains rather than real gains, and the things are not the same. And let me, Chris gave a good description, but let me walk through an example of what I'm talking about here. Say that you are a small business and you decide you want to invest, you've saved and you've scrimped, maybe you've mortgaged your house, second mortgaged your house, and you want to buy, in my example, how about a small auto repair shop. And you purchase this company, it's already existing, for $200,000. 5 years later, you decide to sell it, and the price that you sell it for at the end of those 5 years is $250,000. So, as we all know, your capital gain on that transaction is $50,000. So, with Oregon's 9% capital gains tax rate, you would pay $4,500 in tax. When you combine this with the 15% federal capital gains tax rate, you would pay a grand total on that $50,000 gain of $12,000. Part of that gain, however, is inflationary, standard consumer price index. So let's take an example. If the CPI were 3% a year, and the CPI is different every year, it could be 3%, it could be 5%, it could be 0.5%, but there is, except in very rare situations, there's always inflation every year. So if the CPI, just in that example that I just used with that $250,000 sale, if it were 3% a year, that would equate to effectively $6,000 a year on the investment, or $30,000 over the 5-year life of that investment. So the reality is, on your $50,000 capital gain, in that example, only $20,000 of that gain is real change in value, an increase in wealth, if you will. The rest, $30,000, is wholly attributable to inflation. So back to Oregon's tax on this example. You're paying $4,500 tax, the Oregon capital gains, on that $50,000 gain. That's a $4,500 tax on only $20,000 of gain, not $50,000. So your effective tax rate, the reality, the tax rate you're paying on that wealth and creation is actually 22.5%, not 9%. The effective rate on this example for that $20,000 gain, when you include both the federal and the state, is actually 60%. Even worse than this example, if indeed you believe that scenario is a bad scenario, is the fact that, I'm losing my notes here, consider the point that if your gain were less than that $30,000, anything less than that $30,000, you'd actually be paying tax on a loss. And so that's what this bill is trying to get through, and it's a basic understanding that price changes are not the same as real gains. My point to this is, and I realize that this bill would probably stand a better chance, if you will, if this were 2 years ago, 4 years ago. I realize it's a extraordinarily difficult budget environment, even if we concur that what we're doing here is tax fairness and that we really shouldn't be penalizing inflationary gains, nominal gains, rather than real gains. I think we have the opportunity, however, to say to the rest of the nation, even the rest of the world, that Oregon is open for capital investment. Oregon right now has one of the highest capital gains tax rates in the nation at 9%. There's only a couple states that have a higher capital gains tax rate, and those states are one of them is California, I think the other one's New York, and even within those states, certain capital gains are treated differently. Capital gains, for example, in California, that are held for, if I'm not mistaken, over 2 years, the tax treatment is much less than their full capital gains tax rate. In Oregon, we treat all capital gains the same. It's 9%. Part of the problem with that is that we also, especially with the inflation side of this, that we actually penalize long-term holding of assets. Our system, with the inflation penalty that's worked in there, we actually encourage short-term investments and turnarounds rather than long-term investments and turnaround, because the longer you hold the asset, the more inflation there is that you have to pay tax on. I think this would serve, even without affecting or changing the actual tax rate, I think this would serve as an excellent tool for Oregon to go out and sell itself to investors, not only around the nation but around the world, even if we didn't affect the tax rate, saying that we understand that inflation is an inhibitor here, and that we're addressing that, and we welcome your investments. So that's where we are, Mr. Chair. And I didn't tell you who I was. I'm Scott Bruin, House District 37.
Thank you very much. Well, we get informal on Monday mornings, I guess.
Right.
Questions for Representative Bruin?
Well,
I'm sort of amazed, but it looks like you got off.
Everybody's convinced, right? Yeah. Or Rep. Riley's in shock, one of the two.
One of those other things, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. John Charles, Mike Leachman. Can you two sit at the same table? I guess you can.
Sit on the right here. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit research organization based in Portland. I'm here to support House Bill 3268, and I'd just like to briefly state three fundamental truths of economics that no legislative body can repeal, no matter how much they might want to, which is that incentives always matter, capital is mobile, and those people savvy enough to generate the kinds of capital, the substantial capital gains that you would like to get part of flowing to the state, are also savvy enough to cash out in low-tax states. And no matter how much you may wish that you could get that money flowing to Oregon, capital gains, more so than other types of taxes, are very easy to, for taxpayers to avoid, because unlike income taxes that you're going to pay in real time, capital gains are only paid when the asset is transferred or sold. So for buy and hold investors, by their nature, they're holding them a long time. They can choose. They have a lot of discretion about when to cash out, and if you tax them at too high of a rate, they're not sitting around waiting with some sign on their forehead, take advantage of me. No, they just go somewhere else. Now, what's some evidence here? You know, at the time that the federal capital gains rate was lowered from 20% to 15% in 2003, there were predictions at the time from people associated with it that total revenue would go down by $27 billion. The result was that total capital gains tax revenue actually went up by $26 billion. Locally, the border game that gets played, which is very relevant to this discussion, is that between 1993 and 2002, there were, on average, 337 taxpayers moving to Clark County, Washington, from Oregon. The total capital gains revenue reported from that group was $44.1 million, or on average, the net capital gain was $114,000 per person. The average capital gains paid in the prior year for those people was on average $20,000. So when you know you're about to substantially increase your capital gains, you have an extremely high incentive to move across the border to either Washington or Idaho, where your capital will be treated much more gently. Now, as someone who has been engaged in fundraising for charitable organizations for 30 years, I see this all the time. People who, they're smart enough to get the money. They're smart enough to know how to pay in low-tax states. I think there's also a perception that this would benefit only high-income people, but 76% of all capital gains payers nationally have incomes of less than $100,000 a year, and 23% of income of elderly folks is derived from capital gains. So if you're looking to do something nice for the elderly and those of middle income and upper middle income, fair treatment of capital gains would be a good thing to do. Now, I think indexing for inflation, as this bill does, is a very tiny step towards better tax policy in the state, and at the margin, it may have no effect because it is so tiny. If you're about to sell a business or farm, as people that I personally know have done, and you're talking about a very substantial capital gains. Those are the people whose tax advisors practically kidnap them and deposit them over in Washington State because they just can't stand the thought of having their clients pay so much. So merely indexing, which is a good idea, and I appreciate Representative Bruin sponsoring the bill, but if you really wanted to actually see revenues probably go up, you could return the capital gains to the 4% that it was in 1986, and then you'd have a lot more people just stay in the state, and you have an option of, well, do you want 4% of a very large number, or do you want 0% of a very large number? This doesn't do that, but I do think it moves in the right direction, and I, although it's counterintuitive for people to think that lowering tax rates is likely to lead to higher total revenue, that's frequently the case, whether it's this or excise taxes or other types of taxes. So I appreciate your willingness to listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leachman with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I shared with you this morning a copy of a report that we released last year called No Special Treatment. And it's called No Special Treatment because we believe there's really no compelling argument for giving capital gains special treatment relative to other income, including income from work and other forms of investment. We do, despite our title, we do give Oregon and the federal government give capital gains special treatment. Of course, capital gains income is taxed at a lower rate at the federal level. Also, capital gain, you're allowed to defer the taxes that you pay on capital gains income, and that's a very significant benefit. It's different from the way that we treat investment income from other forms of investments, bonds, CDs, for example. Capital gains are not taxed at all if you pass them on to your heirs. Now, of course, some of that gets picked up by the estate tax, but most of it doesn't. According to the latest tax expenditure report here in Oregon, it's costing that tax break is costing Oregon about $800 million a year in the upcoming biennium. We also don't tax most capital gains on home sales. And there are other capital gains breaks, too, on farm property, on gifts, for example. There are also already provisions in the tax code that adjust for inflation. So, for example, we adjust the brackets every year for inflation. We adjust the personal exemption credit for inflation. We adjust the standard deduction for inflation. The evidence really is that capital gains tax cuts have little impact on economic growth. In part, this is because only a portion of business growth is financed through equity that produces capital gains for investors, and only a portion of capital gains that are earned by investors is taxable. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that cutting the top federal rate on capital gains would increase gross domestic product by only a minimal amount, 0.03% after 10 years was their estimate. The effect of a state capital gains tax cut would be even smaller because not all of the tax savings would be reinvested in Oregon. And lastly, on this issue of the connection between capital gains and growth, Oregon doesn't have an economic growth problem. In the last business cycle that ended when the current recession started a little over a year ago, we saw on average 4% annual growth during those years, and that was significantly higher than the nation as a whole, which saw 2.5% average annual growth over the course of the last economic cycle. So we don't have a growth problem. We have more of a problem with a large percentage of Oregonians not benefiting from growth when we see it. And tax breaks on capital gains income would only make that worse. It is really true that capital gains income is very skewed toward the top of the income scale. while a large share of taxpayers do have some capital gains income, almost a very large share of the of capital gains income is concentrated at the very top of the income scale, and much of the capital gains that most middle and low income families see is in IRAs and other forms of tax preferred instruments. In the report that I passed out, if you take a look at page 4, there's a chart that shows that the highest income 1% of Oregonians would get 70% of an income tax rate cut if we cut the rate on capital gains. Now, this, I understand that House Bill 3268 is a little bit different from that, but just to give you a sense of the kind of concentration of capital gains income that we have here in Oregon. And just finally, it would put a hole in the budget that we'd have to fill by cutting elsewhere. And we just don't believe that tax breaks for investors, particularly one that's so skewed to those at the top, is really how, in the long term, we build an innovative economy or produce strong economic growth. A successful economy starts with investments in the basic building blocks, strong basic education system, well-resourced universities, for example, and this bill would just make protecting and strengthening those basic building blocks more difficult. Thank you for your time.
Questions for this group? Let's start with Representative Riley, and we'll move this way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard half the story about migration, and I'm curious. We know that we have a much higher in-migration than out-migration in this state, and I'm wondering if the people who move into the state pay any capital gains.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, if you're asking the question of me,
yes.
I'd say I don't know the direct answer to that. It would depend on their circumstances. I suspect that if they've been sitting on an asset for a very long time and they have discretion about when, it's unlikely they would move from a low-tax state to one of the highest-tax states to cash out, but that certainly could happen.
Follow, please.
Yes, please.
So, what you did was you did very extensive research on the people moving out, but not on the people moving in. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I did a certain amount of research looking at this. I'm not aware. Let's just say I didn't come across data showing that people would tend to cash out in a high-tax state. It's possible there is evidence of that. It just is pretty unlikely to me.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, on page 3 of our report, we address the question of whether Oregonians are moving to Clark County to avoid paying income taxes on capital gains. And we found that on average only 16 of every 10,000 full-year Oregon taxpayers with capital gains income, that's 0.16%, moved to Clark County each year between 1995 and 2005. Among all taxpayers, those with and without capital gains income, just 2 of every 10,000 moved to Clark County each year on average. So the total capital gains income of households that are moving to Clark County was just a tiny percent. It represented just 1% of all capital gains reported by full-year Oregon taxpayers on average between those years.
Yes, Representative Brune.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure for the benefit of the committee that we're sort of sticking with the issue that's on the table today. Mike, I appreciate your the analysis of some of the reservations you have with capital gains tax cuts in general and your advocacy for no special treatment. And I think that's a great argument to have. But I just want to make sure we're focused on what this bill does. This bill is not a rate decrease proposal. There is a bill out there or two that would do that this session. This is not one of them. This is merely looking at the gains that are caused by no wealth increase, no value increase, but just a nominal price increase, and whether or not it's always the word fair, whether or not it's fair to charge a tax on something that that truly there hasn't been a gain. Now, you referenced bracket creep, if you will, and how we treat that in the federal income tax code. I would argue that that's a good thing we do that. It's a good thing that we move the deductions upwards so that the real inflation that people are seeing in their lives, even if their standard of living hasn't isn't increasing, we're not taxing above and beyond that. Of course, we were doing that in the 70s. That was the era of bracket creep, where people were making, because of the high inflation rates, people were moving into higher tax brackets. They were being taxed a lot more, even though their actual buying power was reducing every year. I'm trying to use that same logic, if you concur with that logic, on this bill, which is to say, hey, if there's a gain, if there's a true wealth change, we'll pay our 9% tax. But if that gain is merely nothing than inflation, should we be paying a tax on that? Should we be paying, in effect, even though we have a 9% tax rate, when we could be paying 100% or more in effective tax rate? And that's the question, really. Love to hear your response to that.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Representative Bruin. I appreciate that we're not talking about a capital gains tax rate cut here. We're talking about something different. I guess that a couple of things. One is that if we wanted to have a system that adjusted for inflation, the impacts of inflation on income, then we would want to do that across the board at the federal and the state level so that all income received that kind of benefit. What we're talking about here is focusing in on a particular type of income, and an income that's very heavily skewed towards people with very high incomes, and giving them that treatment. Also, I would say that
Mr. Chair, we do that, though. That's the point I'm trying to make, Mike. We do that both in the state with our income, which is, 85%, 90% of our tax collections, and we do that on the federal level with income. So the vast majority of taxing that is done right now at both the federal and the state level, we do index for inflation.
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bruin, we do make some adjustments. There are other things that we could do in the code to make a full adjustment for inflation. I have to think about exactly how to do that. But there are certain ways that we're right, and that's sort of my point, that we already make some adjustments in the code for inflation that affect all income, and that's a more appropriate way to go than to target sort of special or additional preference to a certain type of income and a certain type of investment. I also wanted to say that the deferral, the ability of taxpayers to defer the taxes that they pay on capital gains income, is a significant benefit that isn't available to other forms of investment income, to wage income, obviously. So that offsets to a significant degree the impact of inflation. At the federal level, the Congressional Budget Office believes that the deferral and the lower rate on a federal level offset inflation, so that the effective rate, depending on how long you hold the asset, especially if you hold it for a longer period of time, the effective rate is actually tends to be lower than the statutory rate.
Mr. Chair.
I just got one more follow-up. It is a question for Chris. Does Oregon have any sort of deferral method for its capital gains? I I'd love to be instructed if I know differently. My impression was that if you sell go back to my example of selling the $200,000 acquisition asset for $250,000 5 years later, it's always been my impression that the 5 years when you take that capital gain, you're within that tax year, your 9% tax is due. Do we have a way to defer that?
Representative Bruin, in 1997, the legislature passed a deferral for Oregon gains that has since expired. the Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue studied who was affected by that, and there wasn't an overwhelming response to that program. That was basically geared toward the business person who started a business and then wanted to sell it, and then if they cashed out that gains and then reinvested it in Oregon, they could defer the gains. That wasn't it wasn't an overwhelming response to that. I think the deferral that's being discussed here is that any gain that occurs in any given year, that's not calculated and reported on income. One definition of income is to take 2 points in time, January 1st and December 31st, and the income growth in that time period should be taxed, or would be taxed. I mean, that's an argument to be made. And with capital investment, any real gain that occurs in that time, if that gain isn't realized, then that goes untaxed at that point. Right. But you are correct, when you do sell that gain, you know, 5 years or however far down the road, that whole amount does get taxed at that time.
Well, we are connected, aren't we, to the federal definition of income as it applies to deferrals, like deferring taxes on sale of a personal residence, and probably a few other things. Are we not connected on those?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You have the deferral on homes, and then all of the capital gains, the net capital gains that Oregon taxes, is the same net capital gains that the feds tax, whether it be short-term and long-term. And the feds, if it's a net short-term gain that gets taxed at existing marginal rates at the federal level, and net long-term gains get taxed at either 0% or 15% currently at the federal level. All of that in Oregon, as was stated earlier, just gets taxed at the 9%.
Right. And like-kind transfers that are deferred?
Like-kind transfers are deferred.
And anything else? I mean, as far as I know, we're connected on everything.
Yes.
That the federal government defers capital gains taxes, correct. Aren't we?
Correct.
Okay.
So there are a lot of pieces that go in that to defer.
That get to your question?
Well, it does to a way. I mean, I'll finish up. Just one last point. I mean, Chris makes the point very well that capital gains, unlike income tax, regular income taxes, is a choice we pay. We can defer it until we choose to take that to sell that investment and to take those capital gains. Part of the issue that I think we're facing on a larger economic basis right now, Mr. Chair, is the fact that too few people are exercising those capital gains. We have too much capital locked up. I'd like to see that capital more productive. And so anything we can do to incent the unlocking of that capital, I think, is a good thing. And one final point, Mr. Chair, is sort of back to Mike. The point I'm trying to make with this bill is, once again, going to my situation where a small business person buys a auto repair shop, and instead of selling for $250, sells it for $230. There's no gain there. And so my impression of when we're still taxing that $30,000, even though there's no real gain there, is tantamount to a public appropriation of private capital. And that's what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Call?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to dig a little bit more deeply on the deferral concept. Could you walk us through, let's say you have a middle-income family who has a little bit of money that they'd like to put aside, and so they decide to be risk-averse, be very cautious, and walk into a bank and put that into a savings account. Let's say it's $10,000. And let's say we have a bit more affluent family who's a little less risk-averse and decides to go and invest that $10,000 in the stock market. Let's say they both keep it invested for 5 years and see the same gain at the end of each year. Can you walk us through what happens to the person at the end of year one, who's invested in the stock market, and the person at the end of year one who's invested in a savings account, so that we really understand what the deferral looks like?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call. Right, the key difference there is that the middle-income family is getting taxed, as Chris described. The middle-income family is getting taxed each year on the gain in their investment, whereas the more wealthy family can delay paying those taxes until such time as they decide to sell the asset. So there's an advantage there in being able to delay. You know, the value of the cost of that of each dollar that the middle income taxpayer has to pay today is worth more than it would be if they were able to hold on to it into the indefinite future and pay when they're prepared to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Representative Call, guess I'd get back to Representative Bruin's point, which is that the capital gains tax, by definition, is something paid at the end. Yes, to a certain extent, you're getting preferential treatment, and that over time, as its value fluctuates up and down, you're not paying a tax. You're only paying a tax at the time you cash out. So the only question is whether you want to account for inflation at that time. I happen to think that that is a good thing. Now, you could put money into an infinite number of other investments that have different tax treatments, but the subject of this bill is for those investments that people have discretion and eventually cash out as a capital gain.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Oh, and just to comment on Representative Call's question, I think that in that scenario, you know, the family that puts their money in savings and they're taxed every year versus the family that invests in an investment and takes capital gains, they're still getting the, once again, because they're being taxed on an annual income basis, they're getting the inflation adjustment benefit, whereas the capital gains scenario is not. Betwixt, Mr. Chair.
Well, I
have a very small savings account, which I have to pay taxes on with interest, but that's in my personal income taxes,
right,
of which my brackets or my personal deductions are adjusted for inflation every year.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Call.
Representative Bruin, there are many, many moving pieces
now,
on this.
May I remind the committee that we are in public hearing,
yes,
and the object of a public hearing
thank you, sir,
is to inquire of witnesses to gather information.
I needn't respond to Representative Bruin's reply, man. Mr. Chair, I will. I will let him have the last
I should
word.
Have interrupted him rather than you because no. He started it. But
it's his bill.
But,
let's
but
give
you're
him
the one
prerogative.
Who gets it this time. All right. Thank you. Does that lead to any further comments that either of you would like to make?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I am interested in, we have talked about several different places at which the tax system can intervene in relation to inflation. One is proposed by this bill, which would actually adjust, as I understand the bill, would adjust the basis that a taxpayer uses to calculate the gain, adjust that to inflation. That's what I understand the bill does. Okay. Another one is the change that we make in the income tax brackets to account for inflation. That is, every year, if there's some inflation, every year those brackets slide up just a little bit. Every year the personal exclusion gets slightly larger if there's inflation. And the federal tax subtraction gets slightly larger, the amount that you're allowed to subtract on federal taxes. Now, it occurs to me, without actually being able to do the math, maybe I could on another day, but I still have the bug that I had all last week, that these four different adjustments that we're talking about may have very, very different effects in terms of the actual outcome of the arithmetic. Now, have I missed it somehow, or am I right? If you adjust the basis, you've actually reduced the amount that is considered income. When you adjust the rate, you're changing the rate at which you tax that income. When you adjust the personal exclusion, you're increasing the amount you can exclude from your taxes. And when you increase the federal tax subtraction, you're increasing the amount that you're allowed to exclude from federal taxes. Now, that last one only applies to people who already pay more than the equal to or more than the maximum amount of the tax subtraction. So it only affects a small number of people. This question may be incoherent. I'm not sure. But if either of you would like to respond to the fact that it occurs to me that the different bases for the application of an inflation rate may have very different effects on the taxes that people actually pay.
Mr. Chairman, each one would have to be looked at specifically, I think, and you're correct. They all have a different effect, and you also have to determine what is your reason for tinkering. I mean, this particular bill, the issue I believe, is fairness and taking into account inflation and not necessarily the revenue effect to the state, because that might go down. My point was, actually, if you wanted the total revenue to go up to the state, you would do so, take a much bigger bite, lower the tax rate significantly enough so that no one wants the hassle of relocating to another state, in which case then you would get a, you know, 4, 5, or 6% of a large number instead of 0% when they simply leave. This bill isn't really trying to do that, so therefore it would have a different effect. So you have to sort of have to have some clarity of what are you trying to achieve, mm-hmm. and then isolate what you're doing in that context.
Do you agree with Mr. Leachman that the actual effect of passing this bill would have a disproportional benefit for very high-income people because of the fact that they are the ones who take, pay most of the capital gains taxes?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't put it that way. I think any time you put something in percentage terms, that makes it fair. The actual dollar amount is different, but 10%, 9% is 9%, 8% the same. If someone has to pay that across the board, then it's fair. Now, certainly the amount that most tax revenues come from people with the highest income, the highest capital gains. And so, therefore, in dollars saved, they would benefit in terms of absolute dollars. But when things are in percentage terms, I take that as fairness right there.
Okay, now among the things that he said in his report from January 21st, 2008, I don't know if you have a copy of that, but...
No, I don't.
Well, I think you're about to get one. among the things he said in that report on page 4 is, as of 2004, 80% of Americans own less than 10% of total stock value. In Oregon, taxpayers' income between $0 and $100,000 reported just 11% of all capital gains income. And earlier, up above on the same page, there's a pie chart showing the highest income, 1%, get 70% of any income tax rate cut on capital gains. Now, of course, he was referring to rate cuts there rather than adjustments for basis. But the percentages on any capital gains cut, regardless of what the basis, what
The mechanism.
Thank you. Regardless of what the mechanism is, would look something like this chart if he's right about the distribution of capital gains income. Is that correct or not?
If I'm following you, Mr. Chairman, it's certainly true that there are many more middle and upper middle income tax payers, but in terms of dollars, yes, the dollars are going to be at the highest bracket. So if all you care about is absolute dollars, mm-hmm. those highest income people in dollars would benefit the most.
Great. Thank you. One other thing that I'd like to talk about is this business of when taxes get paid. Now, we all know that in the example that Representative Call gave, that if you earn interest, you have money out at interest, you pay your taxes every year because interests are attributable. Presumably, you can withdraw the funds and use that to pay the taxes if you need to. Whereas with the capital gain is only payable when you actually sell the asset. That's something we all understand. There is a significant difference, isn't there, in the effective rate when you do that? If I pay a 9%, if I pay a 9% rate on my interest, then that interest does not roll over into the next year's investment, and therefore I don't earn money on the amount that I paid in taxes that next year. So the next year when I'm paying my 9% on the interest, let's put it a different way. Each year, I lop off a little bit of that interest in order to pay the taxes, and so my effective rate is lower, isn't it? I'm getting a nod from from Mr. Leachman.
Chair Barnhart, that's exactly right and well explained. And
I'd be happy to share with the committee a summary of the research done by the Congressional Research Service released in 2007 that talks about this issue.
I think we'd love to see that.
Okay. The effective rate declines over time for the reasons that you're describing. The benefit of being able to hold on to that asset and not pay taxes until the point of sale is a financial benefit to you, and it means that the effective tax rate declines over time. So the longer you hold the asset, the more benefit there is to that ability to defer taxes, and so over time that drives down the effective rate, which is counteracting the concern that Representative Brune has
about inflation. I think it would be extremely helpful if we could actually see the math, and I suspect the article you're referring to does that.
There is, Chair Barnhart, there is an example. It's not a long piece, but it provides an example that speaks to this question.
I think short pieces work best.
Good.
That's right. Yes. Representative Brune.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to probe a little further with Michael, I'd like to know what the benefit is. I understand what you're saying. You have a capital asset that you're not paying tax on because you have an exercise of sale. Okay, it may be growing in value. But what's the benefit? I mean, the point is, if there's any dividend from that asset, if there's any sort of income gain, realizable income, you're paying a tax on that. So, yes, you have an asset that's going like this, but help me understand what the benefit is, the tangible benefit to the asset holder until they actually realize the gain and have the capital back.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brune. Because you're able to hold on to that value, and you're not paying tax on it, that the value of your asset is growing more than it otherwise would if you had to pay tax every year, like people who have CDs or bonds or other forms of investment do.
That's precisely the insight that the federal government understood when it adopted deferred taxed accounts like the a 401k or an individual retirement account, isn't it? I mean, well, those accounts accumulate income without paying taxes until you draw the money out.
Chair Barnhart, exactly right. In that case, in addition, it matters in some capital gains decisions too. You can hold on to the asset until a point in time when your income is less. And that may have some tax consequences for you too. If you're in an IRA account that is taxable when you take it out, not all are, mm-hmm. But if you're in an IRA that's taxable when you take it out at retirement age, your income may be less, and that may have additional tax benefits to you.
Well, of course, the IRAs that aren't taxable, you paid taxes on the money going in before you set them up.
Chair Barnhart,
yes.
Correct.
Yes, I think Representative Bentz, or no, Representative Call, and then Representative Bentz.
And Mr. Chair, just to add one more benefit, is there's an enormous benefit gained from being able to choose which tax year you get to realize gain in. The person with the savings account doesn't get to choose which year they're having gain, but people who have the capacity to invest potentially pick good tax years to realize gain in, so that they're not maybe paying as much. And there's just so many moving parts with this, with deferring what your gain is. Maybe Mike, you can give a few examples of that. You could talk to that a bit, or not. If it's pretty complicated, I know it's hard to throw out those hypotheticals, and I couldn't come up with one else I would have.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Call, sure, it does have a benefit to you to be able to choose when you when you take that income and pay those taxes. You can make those choices based on what's happening in your income, with your income generally, and that has tax benefits.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Call, I guess I would reinforce something I said earlier. Now your point is certainly correct. It's a benefit that you can pick the year to a certain degree. I mean, my parents can't pick years too much anymore. They have to cash out some things. But that's precisely why, no matter how much you may want to get that revenue in the state, or you may feel that the state should get it. That's exactly why the high net worth people in particular have an incentive to cash out in a low tax state. There's 50 states, and you can, you know, in a border situation, it's the exact same thing that as Mazen Malik has given his presentations I've seen several times about excise taxes, especially with tobacco taxes. If you want more revenue, you should probably lower the tax rate, because then you induce Washingtonians to come over here and buy in Oregon. You have lower black market sales. So at some point, if the rate gets too high, people rationally avoid it, and there's nothing you can do about it. So if you want that revenue to stay in the state, you have to create an incentive, an environment where capital wants to be here. And for people who have appreciated stock, when I have stock outside of my IRA, I'm paying dividend income every year on it, and I'm only hoping that when I eventually sell, I'll have a capital gain. It's possible that I'll have to sell at a loss. Well, that's my reward as an investor. If I can sell at a gain and I have low capital gains, then that's my reward for putting up the cash in the first place.
Representative Benz, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I would remark upon the accumulation of capital, because this is a capital gains tax, and if one glosses over the nature of the assets that are allowed to accumulate, then it's easy to say that capital is receiving some sort of benefit. But, of course, the answer is it's a capital item that enjoys this treatment, because capital is supposed to be generating jobs and other things for the greater good of the community. So, of course, there's a reason that it's allowed to accumulate over long periods of time, because it's doing a benefit for all of us. I just want to mention that, because it seemed to be left out of the previous remarks. I did want to ask, though, your thoughts on just focusing on inflation in one area, because it seems to me that inflation is an across-the-board event, and going in and picking out one device and trying to fix it seems to me to leave out a lot of others. The bracket adjustment makes sense. It's broad. The focusing on capital gains and adjusting it seems focused. So my question is, how, in addressing such a broad impact as inflation, how do we make sure we are addressing all the appropriate devices? And I understand the problem. I understand the solution, but it seems like it's much broader than that which we're talking about this morning.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I appreciate that. It's a very complicated question. I don't think I can answer it well now. I would only say that I think you're on the. I think I agree with you that if we're concerned about this issue, then we need to look at these kinds of broad ways of making adjustments for inflation. And we already do that to some extent with the brackets and with the standard deduction, the personal exemption credit. I think that those mechanisms are more appropriate than ones that target additional inflation adjustments to particular forms of income. I think that it would get complicated if we tried to do much that was very different from what was happening at the federal level, and so probably additional probably would have to think about the federal code there. I'd be happy to think about that some more with you and follow up.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't really have anything more to say.
Thank you.
Than what I've already said.
One final point that I find myself thinking a lot. I don't say it very often, but I find myself thinking a lot, and that is that the assumption in this committee often is that people in their actions are attending to Oregon's taxes alone. And, of course, no one in the real world actually does that. For most people, in most circumstances, the federal income tax or the federal tax system is far, far more significant in its impact than the state of Oregon's income tax is. Now, in this one particular instance, because the federal tax rates have gotten so low, there may be less of that than there are than there is in other situations. We talk constantly about how somehow our 6.6 corporate tax might make a difference if we adjust it in some way or another, when without even noticing the much higher tax rate the federal government charges corporations on the same income, as if the small adjustments we might make have any effect at all on corporate behavior. I simply don't see it. Would either of you like to comment on what I'm just describing just now is the actual impact of federal taxation on people's behavior as compared to Oregon's tax in the context that we're talking about now?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's federal tax issues, well, because they're federal, they're going to apply across the board. So I think that actually makes it more interesting and more compelling what's happening at the state level, especially when you have very significant differences at the border. And in this particular case, California, Oregon, Washington, you have huge differences. And California has the highest. California and New York have the highest. And Washington very low, and Oregon relatively high. That's an issue, as well as what type of tax are you talking about? Well, the capital gains tax is something in particular that people of especially high net worth might be cashing out at a point in their lives, in their 60s and 70s, when they have many, many choices about where to live. So the 50 states are essentially running experiments every day about how do you affect people. You have a floor from the feds, and my goal in all of this is to not give people an artificial reason to leave the state simply to avoid taxation. And I would like to see tax policies that are friendly enough that the hundreds of billions of dollars circling the globe looking for a place to land want to land in Oregon. And if there are people looking to be tax refugees from California, I'd like to see their equity land in Oregon. So we have a high incentive to get it right, I think.
Chair Barnhart, I just say that I agree that the federal code in general has a bigger effect. The taxes are more significant. I don't think I have anything else to add to that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your testimony and the lively conversation that it engendered. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on this bill? And I'm losing track of my numbers here. 3268. I don't see anyone with the courage to take it on, and so therefore we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3268. Thank you, colleagues, for a lively conversation. Colleagues, I want to open the work session, but only just for a moment, and let Chris. Are you on that one?
Yes.
As he's finished passing out the amendments, let him describe just very briefly what this is about, and then my intention is that you read them carefully, be ready to talk about them tomorrow. Is that all right? Let's open the work session on House Bill 2067 briefly for that purpose. The amendment is 16 pages long, and rather than trying to act on it on the fly, I'd rather give the committee a chance to read it and ponder it a little bit. Would you like to describe a little bit what we're dealing with here, and then we'll close that unless there are questions?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2067, as members will recall, takes all of the Oregon tax credits and puts them into three different groups that are somewhat similar in policy goal, and puts three different, gives each credit a sunset so that all the credits are sunset over the course of three biennia. The dash two effectively does that, and that's why it's so long, because it goes into statute and either assigns a sunset date accordingly or moves the sunset date
that currently exist into one of those three groups. So that's why that's so long, and it's a pretty detailed amendment. The dash one amendment pertains to future tax credits and sets a 6-year sunset date on any future tax credits unless the Assembly assigns a sunset date when that tax credit is amended. So then the policy moving forward would be that every tax credit does have a sunset. With a couple of exceptions, I think the personal exemption credit, and then there was the claim of right income credit and the taxes paid to other state, which are kind of those tax-based issues that we discussed before. So those are what the two amendments do.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Reed.
Just a question on the amendment. As I recall, the discussion of the concept of these amendments before we had them was that it would apply sunset dates to those that didn't currently have them. Is that still true here? We're not, in other words, not changing sunset dates on tax credits that already had them. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
If I got that right.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The dash two amendments do, in fact, change sunset dates on tax credits that already have sunset dates, such that they're aligned into buckets, if you will, around different subject areas, so that the committee can dive into one particular subject area each session and make a statement about the relative value of each tax credit.
May I follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Then could you make a general comment about any of them? Generally, it seems when we create a new tax credit, I know in the time that our current chair has been chair, it's been the policy to not do it without a sunset date, but often it seems that we want to have a long enough time to evaluate whether that tax credit is having the effect we want. Does this alter the experimental time for any of those in any significant way, recognizing that's a sort of general question that may not be possible to answer with precision at this point? Does that make sense as a question?
Let me try to take a whack at that. I think the dash one amendments establish a default.
Oh, dash one, I understand. Dash two.
Dash two. I see what you're asking. That would be something, I think, for the discussion after you've had a chance to read it. Because I think what you think is experimental, somebody else thinks is too short or too long.
Certainly, I the beholder.
Representative Call.
Yeah, just briefly, Ms. Chair. By and large, does the dash two amendments track this sheet that we were given?
It does. Apparently it does.
Yes?
Yes. Okay.
So there, just by a quick glance, there are very few of these that actually have the sunset period shortened by putting them into this uniform process.
Mr. Chair, that's an accurate statement. Most of these tax credits that change the sunset date for an existing sunset actually lengthens the time for the sunset. There are a couple exceptions. You'll note
diesel retrofit.
Diesel truck engine retrofit and repower is shortened, although that sunset date is now not up until 2014, so we still have, even though it's a shorter time period, a fair amount of time. There are a few shortly after that on business energy facilities, fuel stations, energy devices that shorten it by one session. Reforestation is a little bit shorter, but so there is a mix of some that are shorter, but the first, the earliest proposed sunset date in the shift is 2014, so there's a couple of sessions to go before then.
Thank you. Any other questions on what you're reading when you read it today? You're going to have 45 minutes before your next scheduled to do anything, and my recommendation is you take a really solid look at it, because we're going to have further conversation tomorrow, and if we think at that point that the amendment's really ready, we may very well move it. Okay, and with that, then we will close the we will carry over the work session on this bill until tomorrow. So we've got it on our agenda for tomorrow, and we'll close the work session. Anything else, Paul, that I need to do? Okay. Committee's adjourned.